Today we'll be discussing endometriosis with our special guest, Dr. Soni Singh. This is Doctor vs. Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Every episode, what we normally do is I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic from medicine and health and grills me on that topic. But today is a special episode. In this episode, we'll be discussing endometriosis with our special guest, Dr. Soni Singh.
I'm going to grill our special guest.
Oh, boy. Stressful. Well, he hasn't gone on the line yet, so he doesn't know how stressful this is going to be. But, you know, we did get a lot of listener feedback saying they want us to talk about this topic. It's such an important topic, especially for women. And we got also men asking us about it, saying, what's with this endometriosis? Because it's something that a lot of people don't know about. So we thought we should not only cover this subject, but get a expert on the show to discuss it. And just so people know, there will not be an entertainment topic this episode, but we will try and tie in entertainment with some aspects of endometriosis towards the end of our chat with Dr. Singh.
Great! Yeah, we're very cognizant of the thought you may have about why are three brown men discussing endometriosis. Would it help if I told you that two of those brown men were doctors, and one of those brown men is Dr. Soni Sukhbir Singh, and he's a professor within the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Ottawa Hospital, University of Ottawa, where he's also department head of obstetrics, gynecology, and newborn care, and he's the inaugural Dr. Elaine Jolly Research Chair in Gynecologic Surgery. That should help. That should help. He's here right now. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Soni Singh.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is great. You know, as we go through this, I think it'll be even more fully illustrated how sort of far-reaching endometriosis is in who it affects and how it affects people. And I think this is going to be quite illuminating. And I think we're going to start with a question that you probably don't get anymore. This is going a way back to your early days, but I would love if you could explain exactly what endometriosis is when somebody asks you what it is. For the lay person, how do you describe it?
Well, first of all, thank you again for having me to talk about this very important issue. So endometriosis is defined as tissue that is like the lining of the uterus that implants itself outside of the uterus. That's the simplest way to explain it. But it is truly a crazy condition where these lesions can grow anywhere. So most typically on the ovaries, on top of the uterus, but can go on top of the bowel, the bladder, and as far as the diaphragm and other aspects of the body, on the skin, outside of the normal pelvis. So it is quite a crazy condition. I don't know what other word to use, because it's unlike any other condition that we see that isn't a cancer. So it's benign, so it's not a cancer. That's very important to remember as well. Now, in terms of its symptoms, how does it present? That's the second component. And the second component is that it presents with painful periods, can have pain with intercourse, and other painful symptoms. But the other sign is infertility or difficulty getting pregnant. So it's a condition that grows outside the uterus, but that can result in pain and infertility.
And how common is it? How often do we see this?
So right now we tell everybody it's about 1 in 10. So 1 in 10 individuals with a uterus and ovaries can have endometriosis. But the problem is we really don't know, because we don't scope everybody. We don't double check in everybody. And there are a huge number of gender diverse individuals where we still haven't even gotten to the research to understand how common it is. So right now we say 1 in 10 individuals, but I think personally it's much more common. To give you another way to look at it, of those with infertility, up to 50% will have endometriosis. With those who present with pelvic pain, up to 30 to 50% will have endometriosis. So my clinics are full, many clinics are full, and there's a need for greater access because of how common it is.
I have two questions that I'm very well known for on this podcast, Sony. One is what causes something, and then do we know why people get it? And Asif commonly gives me the same answer for both. And it's, of course, frustrating for me, but even more frustrating for people in your field. So I'm going to ask it, as I always do, and part of my brain is ready for a certain answer. What causes endometriosis?
So we really don't know what causes endometriosis. It's a fantastic question, because if we really had any clear understanding, then we could actually target the disease specifically. So we mainly treat the symptoms. We help people get pregnant and we try to control or manage pain or the source of pain, which often can be a painful period. And why is it that we don't know what causes endometriosis? This disease has been around for thousands of years. It's not like it's brand new. It's truly because we haven't done the appropriate research. So I think that the basic ideas of, you know, immunologic issues, you know, autoimmune regulation of this tissue, you know, being a little bit off, those are some ideas, but we really don't have a clear understanding as to what causes it. I'm going to leave it at that, because unfortunately, what we need to focus on is getting more research so that I can come back to you and have a better answer. And just to throw out a couple of things we worked on. So the White House, actually, I got to go to Washington, D.C. and advocate on this topic. And for the first time, the White House has put forward a huge amount of money to study and research conditions like endometriosis and women's health. So I think we are going to see that influx of dollars needed to get you that answer. And hopefully, Ali, next time we will be able to answer, you know, with some substance.
That's good. I mean, I'm happy that there's promise in this field that you would have gotten into, I mean, 20 years ago, right? You've been sort of, I don't want to say screaming into the void, but I'm sure there's been a lot of frustration for you for the last few decades. So this is, that's great.
You know what? Let me bring it back. I think when you introduced the idea of why men were talking about this condition, I must say it's not men per se, it's the voices that really got me into this field. It is the strong women role models I had. Being of East Indian descent, there was definitely an issue with, you know, advocacy for women in my own culture and my background. And I saw how hard women had to fight to have a voice. I saw the difficulties in being able to access healthcare, but just in general, the issues that were happening within my own culture. And so this story didn't start 20 years ago when I learned about endometriosis. This is truly a story of advocating for women and girls, and that grew as I went forward. So I had high school teachers, I had people in medical school who really drove me to take a huge interest in women's health. And so today I stand, you know, or we stand before you to really say this is built on years and years of basically the same common theme. Women and girls need access to care, and today, many gender diverse individuals. And this is just a symptom of the bigger problem of gender equality. So I know that's heavy, but it answers to your initial question of three sure. brown men talking about this. I think this is progress. This was not what right. my uncles would talk about at that crazy wedding at midnight, you know, while they're all hanging out. You know, that's what my memories are. They would never talk about women's issues. So here we are. We've turned things on their head.
It is great. No, I'm glad you mentioned it. We don't shy away from those heavy issues. Very important. And anything that gets the uncles to talk about something other than, you know, 9/11 was an inside job or whatever the uncle discussions are these days. This is, of course, very healthy and very promising.
So getting back to what you were saying, you were talking about how some of the symptoms are infertility, pain with intercourse, painful periods. Other symptoms, I guess, is one of my first questions. And are they related? Like, do you get these symptoms every month? Because like with a period, you'd have that every month. Is it related to hormonal changes or something like that?
Yeah, I think this is great. So for the medical people who are going to be listening, the three Ds is what we use. So dysmenorrhea, which is painful periods, dyspareunia, pain with intercourse, dyskinesia, which is painful bowel movements. We had a fourth one called dysuria, pain with urination. And so all of those symptoms are more prominent or happen with the menses, because imagine that the lining of the uterus is a responsive tissue to hormones. And so when there is no pregnancy in that uterus, it wants to shed. That same tissue is sitting on the bowel, it has nowhere to go. So it's just going to bleed inside. If it's stuck on the ovaries every month, there's a hemorrhage in a way that has nowhere to release. Whereas with the uterus, it can release, and that's menstruation. But when it's stuck in the ovaries, it just bleeds every month and continues to bleed on a cyclical fashion. So symptoms that coincide with the period are really the key sign for endometriosis. Now, if you have pain long enough that's repeated every month, then it becomes chronic pain. So individuals, if you don't treat their period pain or pain with their cycles, it gets networked or rewired in their brain that they will now have pain every day. And so that gets confusing. And I was never taught that. As if you and I went to med school together, we were never taught about pain in the way we understand it today. And so that cyclical pain with the periods becomes daily pain. So then these individuals suffer, you know, more days than not.
Yeah. And we see that with migraine. It's a very similar thing. You start episodic and then you can develop a chronic migraine. So, and again, probably through sensitization of these same pain pathways, just a different part of the body.
Exactly.
Can you tell us how it is diagnosed?
So diagnosis is really done by history and physical exam. So we have a guideline coming in, which will be out in a few months, on the impact and diagnosis of endometriosis. And listening to the patient, getting a good history, getting those symptoms out is key. And then the examination, trying to pinpoint where the pain is. That's the art of medicine, Ali. That's the part that really is takes a lot of skill, and it's important to teach students. Now, the imaging is the other one. But if I told you that imaging basically sucks, you know, you'd say, what are you talking about? You can get an x-ray, you can get MRIs anywhere. But the problem is people weren't taught what to look for. So we've had ultrasounds for, you know, years, but it's only recently in the last 10 to 15 years that we can actually see endometriosis. It was always there, but we've taught people now how to look for it. So history, physical, and now imaging, but done with trained readers, which is what we have to teach now. And that's sort of the big mission. We can actually diagnose endometriosis with imaging in good hands.
You're saying that imaging sucks. It makes me wonder, was there a lot of misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis around endometriosis?
So here's the sad story. And you know, like I said, go back to Asif and I trained together.
That is a sad story. A lot of people might need a moment to digest that.
Well, you know, one thing, he hasn't changed at all. That's the most amazing thing. He had an interest in all the stuff you guys talk about from day one. So it's so nice to see that grow. So I'm going to compliment him back, Ali, to show him some love. But when we were in med school, as we were going through, what we were taught was, you know, when somebody comes in with tons and tons of pain, just get them an ultrasound. If the ultrasound is negative, send them away. Like, you know, obviously we can't help them. So can you imagine, Ali, I'm telling you that on that ultrasound, we could have diagnosed. So, you know, 20 years ago, those diagnoses were there. We were discharging individuals, women, girls, saying, no, it's all in your head. And that was just because of a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. And we have to correct that. And still, unfortunately, despite over 10 to 15 years of trying to convey this internationally, it's still a challenge.
You paint an interesting picture there about how many women would have been turned away and therefore have been sort of suffering in silence, or maybe not in silence, but suffering without any knowledge of why they're in pain, and just because, yeah, medicine couldn't help them.
We should stop the podcast there, because Ali, that's it. What you just said is the key message we want everybody to know. People have suffered for a long time, have had severe organ damage, have not been able to have children, and dismissed. And so that is the key message we want to get out.
I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind if we continue with the chat a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You asked us to stop right there, but Can we also keep going also? Is that also okay?
Yeah. I'll bill you for an extra half hour.
Okay, great. We didn't really talk about that beforehand, but okay, that's fine. So we didn't really talk about this, and my wife, who Sony knows, does adolescent medicine. I'm curious, does this occur in teenagers? Because you kind of implied that. And I'm also wondering, say we don't treat them, we'll get to treatment in a second, but what would happen to someone over time? Does the pain and symptoms just get worse and worse? Or what usually happens, especially in these patients who are not treated?
You know, I think adolescence is where we want to catch it. So my friends and colleagues in UBC have a program where they teach high schoolers about pain and endometriosis and gynecologic issues to get the warning signs out there early so that we can treat earlier. Untreated pain in general, as if you know this very well, is not a good thing. And so when it starts at age 12, 13, or 14, you know, the amount of time that young individuals would miss off school, off important interactions with their peers, you know, it can set a trajectory that is significant for them for the rest of their life. They miss their full life potential. That's what we call it in when we look at the long-term impact of this condition. And so getting awareness and early diagnosis is key, and it can start with that first period. And that's the sad part. And in fact, if it starts really early, there may actually be even more serious consequences because it may be a sign of what we call congenital anomalies or problems with how the reproductive system has developed. So absolutely, adolescence is a key time to make the diagnosis.
As you're saying, this is a worry because if it's untreated over time, then you could just expect worsening and worsening of symptoms.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about symptoms. So we go from having cyclical pain to chronic pain. So now you're in pain every day, missing school, not able to function. Can you imagine the impact on relationships and school success or lack of success? But one thing we didn't talk about is the disease itself. So I want you to think about something that's growing every month and you're bleeding inside and it just continues to cause havoc. It causes scarring, and that can lead to what I specifically focus on, which is called deep endometriosis, bowel obstruction. If it blocks the kidney system, it can cause kidney death. I've seen all of these things, by the way, and unfortunately more than an average gynecologist would because I focus on this. It can cause bleeding into the lung. Can you imagine every month an individual having a period and then they're chest wall fills up with blood? So we've had to work with our thoracic surgeons. You know, there's even case reports, as if I don't know if you're aware, of catamenial seizures.
Right, because
of implants. Back in London was one of the first case reports of that. So sorry, catamenial means symptoms that go with the period. And so, you know, these are the severe issues. So if you leave a disease that is a deep version of this, because there's, you know, could be more mild, could be more severe, you're then ending up with severe organ damage. And for a young woman to have a colostomy bag from something that's not a cancer, and it's told that it was just a period problem, is completely, you know, insane. And I think that's where we're struggling, that this is not, even though we call it benign, it is a very severe condition. You know, when's the last time anybody talked about losing a kidney from something that was supposed to be just a simple period problem?
Kidney death. I've never heard of that term either. I didn't know that was a thing. I mean, it's sort of opening up what you see in your life and what, you know, the sort of the tentacles of endometriosis too.
Ali, we should stop the podcast right there because that is the key message that left untreated, you can have severe lifelong impact, including organ damage. So, or we can continue.
We need to get some kind of a podcasting tutor for Sony here. And the first thing the tutor is going to give you is a message. Don't say, let's stop the podcast there after every question. You know, we cannot stop it because Asif alluded to treatment. And now I do want to get some information on that. That's the other question that I'm always, you know, most keen to find out. We don't know what causes it. And yet it's, I think, is it 10% of women? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. So 10% of girls and women is sort of the general number. So worldwide, you know, almost 200 million plus people, but huge number of gender diverse individuals. We don't know the numbers there, but I really do believe it's way more common. But for the 10%, it's the ones who are symptomatic, the ones who actually come to you. But I think it's actually very, very common. I can find it almost in any patient because we know how to look for it.
Tell me about the treatment. I'm guessing there is no cure, quote unquote, but there are treatments that help in some way.
Okay, so I won't say let's stop the podcast there either, because yes, you're right. There is no cure for this condition. And classically, what Asif and I would have been taught in medical school is just take out the ovaries and the uterus, and then they're cured. But even with that, in our very complex cases, it's not always the answer. And you don't want to take out the ovaries and the uterus in a young individual or a young woman. So really, it starts with education. It starts with a full interdisciplinary plan that looks at managing pain, so pain medication, and then ultimately something that controls the periods so that it doesn't cause that painful bleeding and the havoc every month. So hormonal options exist and huge different variations. They're not right for everybody. A key message is there's no one right medication, no one right pill for everyone. So it has to be individualized. And finally, what I focus on is surgery. So when you go in, you can cut out the disease, you can clean up the endometriosis, preserve the organs so they can help someone if they want to get pregnant or give them quality of life. And finally, removing the uterus and the ovaries is, you know, the final answer, but not always. And it's not right for everyone either.
It's a last resort, but it's still not the resort for, it's not a solution all the time.
Well, the problem is that what we were taught, again, because people didn't know how to cut out the endometriosis completely, you would take out the ovaries and the uterus and you'd leave behind the endometriosis. And any remnant of hormone that's in the body, or if you're giving somebody hormones because you took out their ovaries, it can reactivate the disease. It's a very complex surgery. In gynecology, it's the most difficult. So there's, you know, even the oncologist that I work with say that endometriosis is truly the most complex because you have to be so delicate to shave it off all of these other organs, trying to save them. Whereas in cancer, you try to cut everything out. Here, you're trying to save this young individual's fertility and well-being.
So do you have to work with other, you kind of implied this, with other surgeons? Because if you're taking it from the lung or the bowel, like you got to be, obvious, as you're saying, very delicate with that.
Yeah. And in fact, the funny thing, now this is going back, and you've done this in the podcast where you talked about our connections to med school before. So by the way, longtime fan, you love your podcast. The connection here is that actually some of them are our classmates. So I've worked with general surgeons who are our classmates. I've worked with liver specialists who are our classmates, but also thoracic surgeons, urologists. So it's a true interdisciplinary approach. And it's been a real blessing that I have amazing, amazing people who really get it. And that's what's missing worldwide. So when I call them, maybe because I know them from many years ago, and they're kind, you know, they really want to support these young individuals. Whereas the classic surgeon, and I'm not dissing the other surgeons who I've ever met or was taught by, but they're very much like, oh no, this is a female problem, let the gynecologist handle. We really go in as a team and we work so well together. And I couldn't do all of this if I didn't have all these different people. And then we work in trying to give that patient the best outcome.
Just a couple of follow-up questions to that, Sonia. Some stuff you mentioned is very interesting. So do you ever have people who come to you like hoping, because I know you are an international expert, like we talked about, you went to the White House to kind of advocate for endometriosis, so extremely well known internationally. Do you have people come from other places outside of your center, outside of Canada, who are looking for you for expertise, A, and B, can you sometimes not help them? Like, are they looking for something that you're not able to provide? Or do they not have endometriosis sometimes? I don't know.
Yeah, so part A is, when I started, yes, we developed a program that was nationally unique and internationally. So we did see people from all the way from BC to Newfoundland and still get requests. But two things happened. One is we've graduated many fellows, not just in my program, other programs, which are fantastic. And we're slowly placing more people across the country who can then offer care closer to home. The second thing happened was we're not able to take people out of province or out of country anymore because we're just so backlogged. And endometriosis is not seen as a priority program. And it's not seen as a center of excellence type of program, which is what we need, right? You would have one or two places that would deal with that complex case. Like I said, the interdisciplinary care where you have the right urologist and general surgeon to deal with it, well, that's not developed here. And that's what we're advocating for at the national level. Your second question, that's the, you know, I think what you're getting at is, what if patients come and, you know, are expecting that we're going to just cut out the disease, make them all better and cure them, right? There's endometriosis. I think I turn that around to you in a way that we can help every patient, because an endometriosis surgeon should understand chronic pain. So we started the chronic pelvic pain program here at Ottawa, you know, over a decade ago with the anesthesiologist. So we always have something to offer. It may be just education. It may be identifying the pain generators. It's working with people through it. And so when I have that difficult discussion that it's not endometriosis, I've done the surgery, it's not that, I stop and I say, but it doesn't mean you don't have pain. It doesn't mean that you're not suffering. So let's figure out how we can help you. Dysmenorrhea or painful periods can exist on their own without endometriosis. So we work with the patients to make a plan that's right for them. That compassion and that empathy is essential in endometriosis care. It's part of our research program with psychology as well, that we look at validating the pain, working with individuals. Endometriosis is simply one condition out of many. And I think, I hope that turns that question around in that we don't dismiss people, but rather we support them, give them a treatment plan, and then know that they need a lifelong plan. The problem is support and funding to have that kind of program, which is what we're lacking.
And we should stop the podcast right there, I think, with the problem. No. You know what's interesting here? You know the podcast well. Sony, as you're saying, we always do an entertainment topic with a health topic. Today, we're not doing it. But what's interesting is entertainment is, in a weird way, connected to endometriosis. When I told my wife we were doing this interview with you, she said, oh, who's your entertainment person? And I said, we're not doing one. She said, oh, that's such a strange thing because, you know, as somebody who's so interested in celebrity, my wife was like, oh, she just rattled up, you know, Whoopi Goldberg, Padma Lakshmi, Lena Dunham. These are people who have publicly spoken about their endometriosis. And I wonder if I can ask you what that's done for advocacy and for the funding that you talked about, the White House getting on board. How big is this thing with, on social media and it just in general, in news outlets and in the media, people talking about their cases in a public forum?
You know, I don't know of any other disease that has such a social media presence. You know, like Asif, I've heard of all the diseases you focus on, because you do some rare stuff that might be akin to this, right? That, again, rare in the world's mind, but in your mind, you see and you identify with the pediatric populations. But this one is all over social media. And it's because I think years of neglect of not addressing the true issues has forced patients and families to speak up. And, you know, whenever you have a media personality able to be open about it, it makes a huge difference. So Amy Schumer was one of the last individuals who shared her definitive surgery journey with it. And, you know, it really does allow individuals who right now feel like they're alone, because most patients do, they don't know that this is that common, they're suffering in silence. So I feel it gives them permission to do the research, to understand it. On the other hand, then you might get actually incorrect information that, you know, is spread, so that we have to balance what is true versus what is not. But I accept that. I accept that I don't mind the publicity for endometriosis and then just taking the time with patients to explain, you know, what are the options? What are some of the therapies that need to happen? So I think it is a huge benefit. And the final point there is that national action plans have occurred. So France has a national action plan for endometriosis. Australia apologized to women with endometriosis for years of neglect, and their health minister has created a national action plan. The UK has a plan now. Denmark was one of the first ones. And Canada has nothing. That's the problem. Dramatic pause inserted there.
Yes.
I thought your audio cut out. That's how dramatic that pause was. I was like, ah, we've lost you. I was about to say nothing. Yeah, it's tough to do dramatic pauses on Zoom because people are immediately like, are you there? I think your audio's off.
Well, that's what I want to know. Is the government there for us, right? And
yeah,
their audio's off right now, and we're advocating.
Very interesting. If nothing else, they won't spin it this way, but they might be shamed into...
We don't want to shame. We want to work with them. We want to collaborate with them.
I'm not saying you're shaming them. I'm saying the Australian government and what they've done, for example, might cause the Canadian government to be like, oh man, we feel a little bit...
Here I am. I'm trying to be delicate, right? I don't want to make them so upset. I don't want to work with them.
No, of course.
But it is true. They need to know in it. You know what, Ali and Asif, again, three brown men talking about this. It's a women's health issue. It truly is that for some reason, we've accepted this level of pain, this level of organ damage for centuries. And, you know, it's being dismissed. Just to give you a historical context, hysteria, right? The classic readings that you'll read about with women who were presenting with painful periods was thought to be all in their head because their uterus would start wandering around their body and they needed it out because otherwise, you know, this was making them go crazy. Meanwhile, these poor women 200 years ago were probably just suffering with endometriosis and pain. And so it's all linked into this negative, negative dialogue about access to women's health. And again, I don't apologize that I speak about it all the time, every chance I can, because it's the one thing I can do to help my sisters, my mom's generation, and beyond.
You know, on that note, Sonia, I did wonder, this is more of a personal question about your career. You know, like, I love the way you present this, and it is very much, you know, you're working with women, for women, alongside women, and helping. Was there ever any pushback when you entered this field? You know, when I ask you that question, I'm thinking about in acting, in entertainment, often there is sort of pushback of, like, people speaking for other people, and you know, there's like, let people speak for themselves. Did you ever encounter any pushback, and was that a challenge for you?
No, you know, I've been very fortunate because, again, nobody was talking about this, Ali, before. So right now, what I've done is I've sponsored and worked with and hired, you know, almost an entire team that I'm growing around endometriosis care are women physicians who are amazing and leaders who will do much better than I've ever done. But at that time, there was nothing. It wasn't like we had an option. And so, and I'm not speaking for anyone, like you said, I'm speaking alongside them. And, you know, I think it's a very delicate question that comes up. But, and even today, if there was somebody else who was interested in doing this podcast, I would definitely step back at a point in my career. But I'm passionate about it. I love talking about it. And I think most patients, when we've heard that, they appreciate it. But I'm more than happy to step aside for the patient voice. In fact, this past week, we just had a public forum organized by our patients. They led it. They did everything. I was the only male on the panel, and I had a very small part because you build the capacity to allow for growth, and that's where I'm at now. So thank you for bringing that up, and definitely not to replace the patient voice, but instead to complement it and to then set it up for success going forward.
In terms of educating people more about this, and obviously this time we spent has been amazing for that, you'd mentioned to me offline, Sonia, about a documentary about endometriosis. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a great, great documentary called Below the Belt. So again, you know, you're entertainment folks. So Rosario Dawson and Hillary, what's her last name? Clinton, ended up being the producers, executive producers. And Shannon Cohen put it together, who I got to meet and work with. She's a filmmaker who was a lawyer in the past, I think, from Mississippi. And we also got to go to Congress together and meet the senators. So fantastic individual filmmaker who made this her focus. And it's gone worldwide. So, you know, had a small budget, followed three patient stories. One was a Canadian who had to get care outside of Canada. And they follow the stories, and now it's been aired and filmed all over, including PBS picked it up as well. So big names got behind advocacy on this note, and it rallied us to hold sessions like we did in Ottawa at the National Arts Center. We showed the filming. We had 150 people, totally sold out, and then we had a panel discussion. So this is not something you see with other diseases. When's the last time you saw a documentary about diabetes at this level, right? And with this type of social media performance advocacy?
Well, I mean, it's very important. This past month, March, has been Endometriosis Awareness Month. So I think it's so important to not just talk about this topic, but talk about with you, an expert in this field, and to really raise awareness for some of these mic drop statements that you've made during the podcast, which are just so, I just can't stress how important it is, because I've learned a lot. I'm a physician. Obviously, it's not my field, but I learned so much, and I'm sure Ali feels the same way.
Sure. What would you say? Maybe we have like sort of a closing statement so that you can actually end this at some point. We want to be respectful of your time as well. But what would you say the main messages that people who do suffer from endometriosis, what are the messages they would want to communicate to not just to physicians, but to the general public?
Yeah, so there's two messages. For the patients or the people involved, you know, you're not alone. This is truly a real condition that requires expertise and care. And, you know, on behalf of medicine, it's an apology that we've neglected the care and access to these patients for all these years. But please know we're working on it. And every day we're getting better. We're graduating more people who are becoming experts in endometriosis. We're teaching our imaging experts, including radiologists and pain specialist and medical specialist overall. So know that there is hope for patients, families, and the future. But for society at large, let's start talking more about, you know, reproductive health, menstrual health, women's health. Don't shy away from it. You know, I think it's so important that unless we really want to ignore all these issues, it's essential that we focus on reproductive health so those young girls and women can fulfill their potential in their life. And many, many gender diverse individuals who are also affected can fulfill their full potential without suffering in silence and in pain. So the time is now to act and do what Australia and other countries have done.
Thanks, Sony. I think your passion and your tirelessness for this particular field, not just the condition, but as you were saying, reproductive health in general is very much on display. And I don't think this was your goal, but this has been an incredible sort of sales pitch for yourself and your life's work. So thanks for sharing all of this.
And for the patients who I couldn't have done any of this without, because it's a matter of getting them that voice. And I think that's the real important aspect.
Okay. Thank you so much.
So that's our episode for today. Let us know what you guys thought with our discussion about endometriosis with Dr. Sony Singh. I think there's probably lots of our listeners who either suffer from this or know people who suffer from it. So we're very curious to hear your thoughts. Did we miss anything? Anything else you want to talk to us about? Let us know, drvcomedian@gmail.com, drvcomedian on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are everywhere. Ali, anything coming up in April for you?
I'll be in Prince Edward Island.
Prince Edward Island.
Yeah. Charlottetown for a Laugh Out Loud recording. My guess is by this time, this is not tooting our own horn, but it's, you know, it's a 150-seat venue. It's a bit of an intimate space, so it'll probably be sold out. But if you're around and you're listening to this, take a look at, you know, the Trailside Music Hall Laugh Out Loud CBC event that we're doing. That should be a lot of fun. And Parry Sound, Ontario, really like Ontario focused for the next couple of weeks and months, but all that information is at standupali.com.
Sounds good, Ali. But remember that although yes, I'm a doctor and yes, Sony, yes, Dr. Singh is a doctor, we're not your doctor. Medical issues we talk about are for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Bye.